Connie, you made it.
I'm back in business.
Well, that's good. I know Russell's not going to make it today, so I told him I'd record it. I actually meant to record yesterday's and forgot, but this is on autopilot, so it'll automatically record. So.
Oh, I wanted to mention to you the other day, Tuesday, when you were playing the music, I must have an inferior laptop because it was breaking up and I couldn't enjoy the music. But for someone who doesn't know about it, maybe it sounds like that.
Well, no, I think it may have been your internet connection breaking it up, you know. But one of the things you can always do is go on my website. There's a Mozart link. And then I have linked virtually every piece of Mozart, and I have playlists that go with the book. So you can kind of listen. Like the playlist number 12, which is the final chapter, has a bunch of heavenly Mozart. So you could just play that playlist and listen to them all.
Okay, I'll do that. I've been on your website a few times. I've been enjoying
it. Well, you'll see
it.
Mozart as one of the links at the top. Just click on Mozart, and you got everything right there.
I particularly liked the coincidences. thought that was hilarious. It sounded like, what's that guy's, Lewis Black? Kind of humor. That's so funny. Especially the way you kept looking different.
You're talking about the Shakespeare 3-minute video?
Yeah, that one.
It was a competition. I won third prize, which was $250. So I thought I'd do a funny, humorous take on it, and just, the coincidences pile up, and it's funny when, I'll be talking a lot of Shakespeare today. It's funny how Orthodox scholars, and this is something I first found out in college when I wasn't, you know, I didn't have any reason to be really for or against who the author was. I just happened to read a book that was really well done. And I even took it into the university library and checked his sources, because sometimes they make claims about something. And, you know, if you check the source, you'll see something else. Kind of like press conferences and stuff. If you actually watch the speech and then people who report on it, it's sometimes completely different. But I found it was a really solid, well-researched book. So I took it to professors and stuff, said, hey, what do you think of this argument? I think it's well done. I'm having a hard time finding weaknesses. And they didn't even want to open the book. And I thought that was really weird that they wouldn't even. So it turns out Orthodox scholars of Shakespeare, they will not respond to evidence. They either attack the person as crazy, which is easy. I mean, it's easy to say conspiracy theory and all this stuff. And there have been a lot of crazy candidates over the years, because it's been a question for over 100 years going. I mean, even Mark Twain wrote a book called Is Shakespeare Dead? And he questions who the author was. He didn't believe it was, the guy from Stratford. I also did a longer, like a 45-minute presentation at a Shakespeare conference that's on YouTube it's on the crime of writing the Shakespeare plays. And I played the defense attorney for William of Stratford, claiming, look, if writing the plays were a crime, and you had the Stratford guy and this other guy, Edward de Vere, as the two candidates, well, which one would you convict of the crime based on evidence? So I argue why my guy is innocent and the other guy is guilty. And it went over really well. It was the last presentation for the conference, and it's had a couple thousand views, I think. Let's see if I can. I don't think I linked to it on my website. Let's see. YouTube.
I was just reading a funny from my friend Dennis Moss.
Yeah.
A coronavirus funnies. It's day 27.
Yeah.
The garbage man stuck a pamphlet for AA on my recycling bin.
I've been posting some of those kind of things as well. It's rather it's rather funny. Let's see. Where is mine? Oh, okay, here we go. A year ago, 2,200 views.
Yeah.
It's called Mark Alexander, the Grand Jury Indictment for the Crime of Writing the Shakespeare Poems in Play. So if you write Mark Alexander, the Grand Jury Indictment, you'll see it.
Okay. I noticed when you're talking to me, it looks like you're looking at me, but when I'm looking at you, I'm not looking at the camera. So how are you doing it?
I'm not looking at the camera either. It may be just the way that see, right now I'm looking at you. Does it look like I'm looking at you?
Oh, no, it doesn't. Okay.
But if I do this, now I'm looking at you, do I look like I'm looking at you?
Yeah.
See, it's the glasses.
Oh, okay, well, I'll just put my glasses on and then it'll look like I'm looking.
Yeah, I mean, the camera is a little higher than the screen, so.
Yeah. Several people were concerned about my internet being down because I'm the newsletter editor and I'm also the a meetup organizer for Irvine and San Juan Capistrano.
Oh, yeah.
So they were just saying, well, we've got to do this. How do we do it? How? And I said, well, I already did it.
So they came early and fixed it, I take it.
Yeah, under cover of darkness, I believe. I didn't know that it was even fixed.
So it was more a neighborhood thing than just your house?
I believe so. They even sent us a message some time ago that Laguna Woods Village was an old community, and so the wiring is old and it could go down. But it goes down so frequently,
wow.
It's no big deal.
So I'm reading an email from a friend of mine. So the first death in California, this woman, Trish Dowd, I knew her. I worked with her in Silicon Valley. Wow. Well, it's interesting.
I got on early today to make sure I could get on.
And you did.
And I did.
It worked out well. Well, I'm glad you did.
Me too. What did I miss yesterday?
Well, let's see. We talked some music and some Shakespeare.
Okay.
Yeah, Mozart and then other things. But today I'll just do probably mostly all Shakespeare. I also made some, did I do movies on Tuesday? Movie recommendations? No. I did some movie recommendations. I may finish up today with some more. Are you watching movies at home now?
No, I don't listen to music, nor do I watch movies.
Do you read books?
Sometimes.
What do you like to do?
Well, if something's really bothering me or something has happened and it's big enough, I'll write sort of like the Perils of Pauline, but okay. I call them the Millicent Chronicles. And yeah. And I put a humorous slant on it because it bothers me so much.
Well, that sounds fun.
But I'm doing a lot for the two X centers. They own me.
So they're just keeping you busy, huh?
Oh, yeah. They have this whim. Or it's mostly Carol Freisinger has a whim. One thing is she'll tell me something, and if I disagree with her, she knows that I'll do it anyway.
Yeah.
She just knows me. But at least I have my two cents in. So I've been busy doing that stuff.
Well, it's been a busy time for all that stuff since everybody has to figure out how to do the online version of everything.
Yeah, I think they're doing very well. There's a lot of interest.
Yeah, and then right about the time everybody really gets comfortable with it, we'll be back live in class. But I think something out of this will happen where, for example, I think that some people will be doing classes. It'll make it easier to do classes for people out in the regions.
Hi, yes, Micheline. That's true, and it'll be an easier way for seekers to take a peek at it.
Right. Yeah, I had somebody last night come on, just audio, didn't show their face. And after about 5 minutes, they disappeared. So it's
okay. Hi, Micheline.
Hi, nice to see you. So your internet is back to work.
I'm not broken anymore.
That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, a lot of people are very happy.
Yeah.
Well, you're one of them. It happens frequently here, and you just take it in stride. It's an old community built in the 60s, and they thought because we're old, we wouldn't need very much internet service or wiring. And
that may be the opposite.
It's the opposite now, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad everything is normal now.
Yeah.
I was worried for Meetup. I said, oh, no, it's not going to be there. So.
Oh, I didn't read that part. I thought you were talking about the other people. I don't have a very large list, like maybe three people. Barbara Stoker is one of my friends. You had put her.
Yeah.
I remember
that little list I send you.
Yes.
Okay.
And Azita, is that the Azita from Texas, or is this another Azita?
The other Azita.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
So I'll be sending that out after our meeting today.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for doing that.
You're welcome.
Mark, I have a question for you.
Okay.
We can have, of course, we can buy your book online, but what if we would like to have the book to be signed?
Well, hang on just a second. I'm finding something that I want to start and stop. Okay, there we go.
Hey, Micheline, can you see my little houses up?
Yeah.
Up on the window
yeah,
houses?
Cute. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
So, yeah. So if you want, you can, send me a check. I got copies here that I can, I got a bunch up there.
Ah, okay.
And I can sign them and send them to you if you ever need that. Russell, I didn't think he was going to make it today. That's why I'm recording this one. Huh, cool. So do you have my address?
No, I'm going to take that. Okay, Mark.
Oh, actually, it's in the book. You got the book. In the within the, like, the title, the page where you were, yes, I am recording it.
I have the older edition, though. Would that be in there?
It'll say Auburn, and the a P.O. Box 5284, Auburn 95604.
Okay.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Yeah, we're recording, Russell, so you're good. Thanks. All right, he's gone. So he just wanted to make sure I remembered.
Okay. It's been so nice, Mark, to give your time to do that for all of us, because it's been so helpful.
Good. This will be the last one, just because I got to start putting more attention on actually making money.
Of course.
Because, yeah, it's. I'd hate to have to move again.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hello.
Tammy.
Hello. Hi.
Aha, there we go.
We all have glasses.
That's true.
Oh, here's
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Hi, Michael.
I'll have to mute myself so you guys don't hear the ambulances going by. I live in a retirement community, and they're just dying to get out of here.
Oh, that's a haunted mansion joke. I know that joke.
There goes one. No siren, though.
Hey, Rydell.
Hi there. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm fixed, Michael. I don't mean I'm fixed, but the computer's fixed. The internet's fixed. Oh, I'm fixed too.
Okay, so now your cat is fixed and your computer is fixed, so everything's good.
We were broken.
Glad to hear it.
Well, what I will do today to finish up is I'm going to do Shakespeare stuff, and I'm going to give you all you need to know to help you kind of carry on if you want to crack open Shakespeare and understand the value of Shakespeare. Hey, Debbie.
Hi.
Debbie made it.
Hi, Debbie.
So I was just telling everyone I'm focusing on Shakespeare today, and I'm going to give you a lot of tools and stuff to go on. So I already told you about my book, the one I wrote in my past life, The Meaning of Shakespeare, by Harold C. Goddard. Volume one is all you really need to start with. Don't buy volume two unless you're like, oh, okay, now I want to know about the tragedies and all the other stuff. The book that was, it wasn't reading this that triggered the lifetime. It was a book that I found. I was in a Berkeley used bookstore with a friend from college, and we had both done Shakespeare together. And he said, hey, here's a book by that guy you like, Harold C. Goddard, called Alphabet of the Imagination. And I almost didn't buy it, but then I just had that nudge, no, I'm going to want to buy this. And it's just a collection of essays that his daughters compiled. They were in their 70s, back in the 1980s, I guess. And I was reading through, and there was one on the key to Walt Whitman. And in there, he said something that I had thought, but I had never heard anybody else express. And that was just like, wow, this guy actually thought something that I had thought, but nobody had ever said. So I looked him up in the back, like, who is this guy? And it's like, oh yeah, he was born in 1950. I was born in 1956. He started out, got his degree in math, but then changed to English literature. And it's like, oh, that's like me. I started out in math and science and then changed to English. And then at a certain point, I just had the thought, I wonder if this could have been a past life. And it was like breaking through a pane of glass or something. It was very weird. And I very rarely had any phenomenal experiences. But it's like everything said, it is you. I break through this glass. I tossed the book. It was really good. My roommate wasn't home at the time because she would have freaked out. I threw the book, jumped up off the couch, and kind of ran across the room because it was pretty shocking experience. And after I calmed down, I even was like kind of teary or something. I went back and started reading, but with new eyes. And that's when it's when I recognized the consciousness, the way the language structures work, the way everything. I realized, oh, this is me. And so I would read this. You know, these meaning of Shakespeare, I went back and reread them and realized how much of me was in here already. And I guess that's true since it was just the last lifetime. So this is a good one, especially if you're going to watch a Shakespeare movie, you can flip in through it and read that section and get a real, I would say, an inspired take on that particular play.
Mark, I'm sorry, I missed what the title of that is.
Oh, yeah. It's called The Meaning of Shakespeare. It's been in print and published by the Chicago University Press for 70 years. It's never been out of print, so it's pretty popular. The Meaning of Shakespeare by Harold C. Goddard. This is volume one, and I think you would just start there if you want to read.
Thank you.
The other book is blue, looks like this, volume two, and it covers a lot of the later plays, the tragedies and such. But I'm going to talk Shakespeare today and just kind of give you some tools. So one of the best ways perhaps to start is with Kenneth Branagh's first Shakespeare movie, Henry V. And I want to play a little clip from it to give you a sense of what he does that other people don't do. You could go back to earlier ones and find clips with Laurence Olivier. I think, Laurence Olivier was more of the stage school of Shakespeare, whereas Kenneth Branagh tends to be much more realistic. Right. And because of the way he speaks it, it's a lot easier to understand. In fact, when you're reading Shakespeare to yourself, speak out loud, read it out loud. By hearing yourself read it, you'll actually understand it more and you'll be less reliant on the notes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a scene from Henry V, and this is a classic scene. So this is based on history. Henry V, you know, he has troubles at home, so this is a good time to get involved in foreign wars. And so he goes to war with France, and the night before the battle or the day before the battle, they have like a whole lot more men. So it looks pretty bleak, and you'll see the guys are kind of like, oh no, this is not really good. So it's the king's job to inspire them. Okay. So this is one of the most famous speeches in Shakespeare where Henry V, inspires the troops in a sense, to go to battle. And he does it in a very, very unique way. What the play does not reveal, the reason the British were outnumbered historically, the reason why they won is because at that time they had invented new bows and arrows, and they were just so capable. They just had better weapons than the French. So the French lost. Also, it's the one play in Shakespeare where there's an entire scene in French, and you don't have to know French to understand the scene. It's really incredibly well done. So let me share the screen and play Henry V. Okay.
Where is the king? The king himself is rode to view their battle.
I hear it.
Can you hear it?
No.
Well, it's just music right now. Hang on.
A fighting man. They have full 70,000.
Can you hear it?
That's 5-1.
Yes.
Besides, they are all fresh. It is a fearful art. Oh, that we now had here. But 10,000 of those men in England that do no work today.
What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? No, my fair cousin. If we are marked to die, we are enough to do our country loss. And if to live, the fewer men, the greater share of honor. God's will, I pray thee, wish not one man more. Brother, proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand at tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall see this day and live old age will yearly, on the vigil, feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is St. Crispin's. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, that all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few. We happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhood's cheek, whilst any speaks that fought with us. Upon St. Crispin's Day! For sovereignty!
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So what's brilliant about that, well, they're concerned because there's so few of them. And what does the king do? He makes few the virtue. He turns it into the strength, the reason. And it's through his inspiring talking that he does it. All great military leaders have this skill. Patton had it. He knew how. He got loyalty. Other great leaders do it. Did any of you see the movie Patton? Do you know how? If you go back and look, you'll be shocked at how much it's about past lives. References to reincarnation. He believed in reincarnation. He believed he was earlier warriors, and it's a fascinating. Go back and see that and realize. In a way, it's one of the central themes of the entire movie. So, were you guys able to understand that okay?
Yes. Yeah. It's a little choppy, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. If the internet connection is not the best, then let me take a quick look and see. I bet I may be able to get my boom connected to my. When I say boom, I'm talking about this baby.
By the way, I've been told you can improve your internet connection if you can direct cable link your, in other words, use your cable instead of the Wi-Fi. You get a better connection. That looks better. Mark, can't hear you.
You're muted, Mark. Mark.
Hear you.
Mark.
Can't muted. Hear you. Can't hear you, Mark.
You'll get it. Don't worry.
You lost your voice. Yeah, you're muted.
Lorraine?
Yeah.
Can I just ask you in this moment if you could send me the info for the Zoom classes for Irvine? I know there's one this Sunday with Kathy.
Okay. I'll have Ken put you on the contact list.
Thank you, dear.
Now can you hear me?
Yay! Yeah.
This is this speaker somehow screwed up everything. So I will not do that again. Okay. So, Joy, I'm glad you've joined us, and Christine. So, yeah, hi. We're talking Shakespeare today mostly. If Shakespeare isn't the most interesting thing to you at the end, I'm going to give some more movie recommendations that aren't Shakespeare.
Okay. Have you seen The Renaissance Man with Danny DeVito, where he is teaching English in a military camp?
It was a while ago, but I saw that. Yeah,
it was a good one because they did that speech. It was really great.
Okay, the next Branagh film I recommend is Much Ado About Nothing. Now, he has a habit of finding famous people and putting them in, even if they're not the best for that role. But, you know, it helps with sales. and he has Keanu Reeves in this, who actually, it doesn't seem great, but he's actually well-suited for the role. The hardest thing I have with the Kenneth Branagh one is Michael Keaton as Dogberry. There's actually another version by Joss Whedon, the guy who did Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Firefly. His Much Ado has Nathan Fillion as Dogberry, and Nathan Fillion is great. It's all shot around his home. So I'm gonna share the screen again. And I wanna show you, not this, let's see, get that out of the way. Stop it. Everything wants to insert itself. Oh no, I was in the right place after all. I should have stayed there. Okay, hang on. Yeah,
we're hanging.
I want to go to YouTube. I want to go to my thing, and I want to go to library and playlist. Ah, Shakespeare. Here we go. Well, before I do that, let me show you something. Now, this is on YouTube, and it's there's a guy. Right, let me bring these over here. Right. There are some master classes, 9 of them, from the Royal Shakespeare Company with a guy named Jonathan Barton, and this is a great, great series, but they're all on YouTube. There's 9 episodes, and let me play one of them for you. If you work through these 9 episodes, they're all about 50 minutes long. It will give you some real practical, in-depth understanding of Shakespeare and Shakespeare's language. So let me do this.
In our first program, we suggested that the main problem in acting Shakespeare is how to marry an Elizabethan text and acting tradition with a modern acting tradition. 2 of the main points we made were, first, that the heightened language has to be found by the actor and not just taken for granted, and secondly, that a right balance has to be found between naturalistic and heightened elements in the text. But most of the plays are also in verse, or else very often in heightened rhetorical prose. Blank verse is probably the very center of the Elizabethan tradition, and perhaps the most important thing in Shakespeare that an actor has to come to terms with, or rather I should say that an actor needs to get help from. I stress that because many actors, particularly if they're not familiar with Shakespeare, very understandably look at the verse as some kind of threat. They know they will somehow come to grief if they ignore it, or be chastised if they do it wrong. It becomes a mountain to be climbed, or else an obstacle to be avoided. But no, it's there to help the actor. It's full of little hints from Shakespeare about how to act a given speech or scene. It's a stage direction in shorthand. So let's try to find out how his verse works. Don't let's ask what it is, for it's nothing static, but let's ask what goes on in it. Shakespeare was an actor, and his verse is above all a device to help the actor. It doesn't necessarily or always have something to do with poetry, though it often does. But at the beginning, we can forget that. Now, how do you all think that it helps you as actors?
Well, it helps the actor to learn the lines.
It helps to give him his phrasing. Blank verse makes a pattern on the page which is easier for the mind to retain.
It's also full of directorial hints.
And because verse is a more economical way than prose of saying something, it's likely to be more concise and more particular and exact. And at the same time, because a verse has a rhythm to it, a flow, it's perhaps more attractive to the audience to listen to and helps the actor to keep the attention of the audience.
Yeah, so you're going to see a lot of famous actors in here. Patrick Stewart, Judy Dench, and they're all very young. But this is, you can see already, this guy, Barton, is just, he's brilliant. And he brings something to actors. Any of you ever do any acting? Community theater acting or anything? Okay, well, and until I saw this series many years ago, I had no idea the extent of which Shakespeare, in the way he's written it and how it is on the page, how it can communicate to the actor what to do. It's really a stunning thing. I'll play one more here. Let's see. Just a little passage here, because this one's kind of fun.
And Rosaline, they call her Rosaline. Ask for her, and to her white hand, see thou do commend this sealed up counsel. There's thy garden.
This is from As You Like It.
Garden. Oh! Sweet garden! Better than remuneration. 11 pence farthing better. Most sweet garden! I will do it, sir, in print. Oh, garden! Remuneration. Good. Well relished. Verbal relish. They were a bit apt to fight shy of it. But until we love individual words, we cannot love language. And if we don't, we won't be able to use it properly. As most actors' instincts push them towards the naturalistic, they don't go far enough. I believe that in rehearsal, at any rate, we should tend to go too far because we can always pull back later. So let's start exploring Shakespeare's language by looking at one or two individual words. Lisa, what would you say, if any, is the most important word in Shakespeare?
Remuneration.
Time. Yes, time, indeed. It's dangerous territory.
Ben Kingsley.
There was a wonderful skit on television last year about a director telling an actor how to use the word. All right, let's start right at the beginning, shall we?
Right, yeah.
What's the word? What's the word, I wonder, that Shakespeare decides to begin his sentence with here?
Time. First
time.
Yeah.
Stephen Fry, right?
This is a skit. Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry.
How does Shakespeare decide to spell it, Hugh?
T-I-M-E.
T-I-M-M-E.
Yeah.
And what sort of spelling of the word time is that?
Well, it's the ordinary spelling.
It's the ordinary spelling, isn't it? It's the conventional spelling. So why, out of all the spellings he could have chosen, did Shakespeare choose that one, do you think?
Well, because it gives us time in an ordinary sense.
Exactly, well done, good boy, because it gives us time in an ordinary, conventional sense.
Oh, right.
So, Shakespeare has given us time in a conventional sense.
Yeah.
But he's given us something else here. Have a look at the typography. What do you spy?
Oh, it's got a capital T.
Shakespeare's T very much uppercase there,
yeah.
You, isn't it? Why?
That's word in the sentence.
Well, I think that's partly it. Another reason, too. Shakespeare has given us time in a conventional sense,
uh-huh.
and time in an abstract sense.
Right.
All right?
Yeah.
I think your voice can convey that.
I hope so.
I hope so too.
Just the one word.
That's the one word for the moment.
Yeah. Okay.
Where do we gather from?
Oh, the buttocks.
Always the buttocks. Sorry.
Yeah.
Gather from the buttocks. Right.
What went wrong there, you? I don't know, I got a bit lost in the middle, actually.
Okay, so that's just gives you some glimpses of what's in here. It's not all just serious stuff. They illustrate a lot of fun things. So yeah, there are 9 episodes, RSC, Playing Shakespeare, load them up and just kind of occasionally work through one of them. If you get half of what you're seeing in this, you're doing really well. As Shakespeare grows, because it's kind of a lifetime of learning, you'll go back to these and you'll get a whole lot more. But he's really good about laying a foundation here. Yes. Here's about here's Judy Dench. What's that?
I was just saying, yeah, there's Judy.
Yeah, let me play this. This is a good one.
It's like I have a sense of poetry that is innate, that it's like a natural musician. Did you always know?
I don't think so. I think I was taught that.
Taught by
Peter Hall and John Barton and Trevor Nunn and you. All the people I've worked with. And Peter, yes, it's true, Rich. And when Peter Hall directs, he stands at a lectern, and you'd be rehearsing in front of him, and he would be looking at the lectern, and he would beat out the meter. Can I tell you a very quick story about Antony and Cleopatra? When he was trying to get the meter of her death right with Miranda Richardson and Helen Fitzgerald, and he was trying to say, oh, alas, alas, our noble lady's dead. And then it goes on and on like that. And it was only meant to be called for an hour and a half. It went on the whole morning, and I was lying there like this, pretending. And eventually he said, alas, alas, our noble lady's murdered. And there was a pause, and he said, thank Christ. So it was drummed into you, see, early. Into you really well.
I would say that the opposite is true, that Peter learnt from you. That you had an innate musicality, innate sense of rhythm, and that you're, like all the best actors of Shakespeare, you're like a jazz singer. You move, you know, you sing...
Oh, I wish I was a jazz singer.
Well, you sing across, you know, you cross the bar lines. You see that you don't... somebody can't sing jazz, whereas you're all over, and yet you finish within the phrase. It's just the phrasing within the sort of 8-bar figure is all your own.
And well, Sir John used to do that, didn't he? Sir John used to present the whole thing as an arc. I've often said to young students, if you want to speak Shakespeare and learn about making a speech, you should listen to John Gielgud and Frank Sinatra. Because Frank Sinatra presents you with the entire song. There's no spending too long on the beat, you know. And also, if you look at and you learn in the script, you know that where you must obey the what's that word called?
Well, blind endings.
Yes, blind endings. You know, if you get a half line, when you see the script and you get a half line, and then the next person starts with another half line, that is all one line. If, on the other hand, you get a half line and the next person speaks with another half line underneath it, you know that in this pause to complete the line, something happens.
And it's absolutely invariable. And it's so simple. And it's so shocking that the teaching, I mean, we moan about it occasionally, that young actors now have a very, very difficult time because they don't get taught the rudiments of speaking verse. And so they try and pull it around and make it naturalistic and not see that actually you can just be truthful and naturalistic as you can with a song within a specific time signature.
You can be much more colloquial and naturalistic if you obey what he tells you, and you also will never run out of breath.
Yes.
Because he gives you a place to take the breath.
Yeah, you can type in almost any famous British actor and then Shakespeare, and a video will come up where they're talking about it, and it can be pretty fascinating. So let me see. How many of you have seen Much Ado About Nothing with Kenneth Branagh?
I did a long time ago, but I don't remember very well right now.
Yeah. All right, so this is one of the great comedies of Shakespeare, and this is also where Kenneth Branagh met his wife about the time, Emma Thompson. It only lasted a few years, I think I know why, but they really hit the characters of Benedict and Beatrice really well. And by the way, Much Ado About Nothing, in Elizabethan England, it would have been, it would have come under, the pronunciation would be more like Much Ado About Noting, and there's a play on words there, because noting is another ways for a word for eavesdropping. So Much Ado About Eavesdropping, and there's a lot of eavesdropping that takes place in this, especially at times the kind of eavesdropping that where they get it wrong.
That never happens.
Yeah. By the way, the book I recommended, you know, the Meaning of Shakespeare book, I think chapter 9 is called The Poet Playwright. That's a great chapter to read to understand that Shakespeare operates in the theater, but he also operates as a poet, and he will communicate things as on the stage that you don't necessarily see in the reading, but he'll communicate things in the reading which you would never catch on the stage. And to understand that there's this dynamic in his consciousness where he's working with illusion, but also trying to tell the truth, so that he will have one thing, but if you're paying attention, often what you're seeing, the truth is exactly the opposite of what you're seeing on the stage. So people who just see Shakespeare on stage or in movies will never fully comprehend what he's doing on the page. For example, in Macbeth, you don't see Macbeth right away. People are talking about him, what a great warrior he is and all this. And they're talking about another warrior who betrayed the king and was hanged. And the king is talking about him and says something to the effect of, you never can see the mind's construction of faith. In other words, the face may look like they're loyal, but the mind could be a betrayer. And then you have Shakespeare has a stage direction, and all it says is "Enter Macbeth" after that line, which on the page clues in the actor right away. Okay, this line is actually about Macbeth, but we don't know it yet. It's a form of Shakespearean irony. So let's see. I'm not sharing the screen right now, right? I'm not. So let me share. Am I boring you guys yet?
No.
Okay, good. Okay, so this is Much Ado with Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson. This is near the beginning of the movie. They've just, Kenneth Branagh and the gang have just returned from winning a war of sorts or some kind of battle. And obviously, Benedict and Beatrice know each other from past. They've had a history.
Even though you may be apart, you can still share love with your mom from anywhere. Because right now, a little...
Okay, here we go.
You'll be talking, Signor Benedict. What, my dear Lady Disdain? Are you yet living? Is it possible Disdain should die while she has such meat food to eat? Courtesy itself must convert to Disdain. You come in her presence.
Then is courtesy a turn.
I am loved of all ladies, only you accepted, and I would I could find in my heart that I have a heart. I love none.
A dear happiness. They would else have been troubled for the pernicious suitor. I thank God and my cold blood I am of yours. I had rather hear my crow than a man swear he loves me.
God keep your ladyship still in that mind, so some gentleman or other shall scape a predestinate scratched face.
Scratching could not make it worse, and for such a face as yours were.
Well, you are a rare parrot, teacher.
A bird of my tongue is better than a beast of yours.
I would my horse had the speed of your tongue. Keep your way, in God's name, I have done.
You always end with a jade's trick. I know you're wrong.
It's really hard to hear.
Is it?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. I'm going to go watch it.
Well, yeah, do. Read the section in the book, because he will clue you into things that you would not normally know about. But yeah, that one tended to be a little bit...
Kenneth Branagh has really... He was the one that really turned me on to Shakespeare. I always liked Shakespeare, but for... He's just so neat, the way he makes it accessible. And...
Yeah,
and I especially like that the young kids saw him on Harry Potter, and he had a great part as a egotistical, vain professor. And you know, so it's neat that crossover that occurs when they see that fantasy, and then they, oh yeah, Kenneth Branagh's doing, you know, Midsummer's Night's Dream, anything. To me, it's magic. The casting is always magic. I like his stuff.
Yeah, he's the only person who ever did the full 4-hour music version of Hamlet. Oh, Hamlet, as written in the what's called the Second Folio, is a 4-hour play. It was never written to be produced that way. In Elizabethan times, 90 minutes to 2 hours max. And there's even an edition of it where it's cut down. But once you realize who the true author is, and this is if you ever get through the other stuff and you're ever interested in authorship studies, this is a friend of mine, Mark Anderson. He wrote Shakespeare by Another Name, The Life of Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford, The Man Who Was Shakespeare. And he just starts with the assumption that you already know that this guy is Shakespeare, and then he just ties it all together beautifully.
What's the author's name?
Mark Anderson. We've done presentations at Shakespeare stuff. People will get us confused, so people will compliment me. Like,
I bet.
Yeah, I know I didn't write the book, but I did do the article on Shakespeare's knowledge of law and that kind of thing. It's an excellent book, and it's not the 900-page tome that got me into it. That one, I don't even have it down here anymore. It's like, it's an incredible detective story. That I highly recommend if you ever really want to go deep, but that's usually for people who are real, you know, serious about it. He also did a version of Love's Labour's Lost, which is a lot of fun. It's not, both this and his As You Like It are both non-traditional in what he does, but what he does is very smart, and I just love them both. This one is not the Kenneth Branagh one, but it's Twelfth Night, brilliantly done. This one's a lot of fun, and I highly recommend it. Let's see, whatever. So between Barton and the videos, oh, and by the way, I have some videos too. Let me show you a bit of one. So a couple years ago, I was going to give a lecture at a Shakespeare conference. They were in Oakland, so I could go. And it wasn't, they usually do these in October, and it was like a couple weeks before the worldwide, so it was no problem. And they wanted, they had a competition with three-minute video. And I did one, I wanted to do something humorous. And I actually won third place and $250 for this. Hopefully you'll be able to hear this. I think it'll be louder.
Mark Andre Alexander. Many claim that Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, is Shakespeare's Hamlet, but I'm here to assure you, it's just a coincidence. Scholars have noted the parallels between Polonius and William Cecil, Lord Burleigh, and even how Burleigh's daughter Anne mirrors the fair Ophelia
And sure, Oxford did grow up in Burleigh's household and marry his daughter, but it's just a coincidence. Scholars believe that Carden's Comfort is the kind of book Hamlet would read, and sure, the 1571 translation of Carden's Comfort was dedicated to Oxford, but it's just a coincidence. Castiglione's The Book of the Courtier is associated with both Hamlet and Shakespeare's idea of courtliness. And yes, Oxford did write the Latin preface to the 1572 translation, but it's just a coincidence. Shakespeare was immersed in Arthur Golding's English translation of Ovid's Metamorphoses, and Arthur Golding was Oxford's uncle and both did live at Cecil House, but it's just a coincidence. Do you know pirates attacked Hamlet in the English Channel, and pirates also attacked Oxford in the English Channel? Many silly upstarts like to point out that both were noblemen and courtiers, had mothers who remarried after their father's death, were spied upon by their fathers-in-law, who were both counselors to the throne, were patrons and players and playwrights, had lovers accused of infidelity who died early, and were thought mad at court. But it's just a coincidence. Scholars believe Shakespeare visited Italy due to his profound knowledge of the country, and Shakespeare does make reference to Venice, Genoa, Milan, Padua, Florence, Verona, Messina, and Sicily. And sure, Oxford visited all these places, but it's just a coincidence. The English poet and dramatist John Lyly was a great influence on Shakespeare's comedy, and yes, he was Oxford's secretary, to whom he dedicated his Euphues and his England. Scholars also see ties between Shakespeare and playwright Anthony Munday, who worked for Oxford and dedicated several of his works to him, but it's just a coincidence. Oxford dedicated his poem Venus and Adonis to Henry Wrosely, the Earl of Southampton, and sure, Burleigh did approach Southampton to marry Oxford's daughter Elizabeth, but it's just a coincidence. The first folio is dedicated to the brothers William and Philip, the Earl of Pembroke and Montgomery, and Pembroke was once in negotiations with Burleigh to marry Oxford's daughter Bridget Vere, while Montgomery actually did marry Oxford's daughter Susan Vere. But it's just a coincidence. So Hamlet has a fanatical sense of truth in that in one place Shakespeare does say truth is truth to the end of reckoning. But so what if Oxford used a similar phrase in a private letter to Robert Cecil, or that Oxford Latin motto can be translated as nothing truer than truth? It's all just a damn coincidence.
They look alike too.
Yeah, that was a fun one to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you type in Shakespeare and Marc Andre Alexandre, you'll find a couple of mine. There's one I also did. The presentation I was talking about, they recorded it and put it up. It has almost 2,300 views so far. One person didn't like it. Oh well. And basically, this is about it's Marc Alexandre, the grand jury indictment for the crime of writing the Shakespeare poems and plays. And the idea is that what if writing the plays were a crime and you wanted enough evidence to convict somebody? If you had William of Stratford and Edward de Vere, and you're going to look at the actual evidence that is out there, who could you convict? So I play the lawyer, the counsel for the Shakespeare of Stratford, explaining why my client is innocent and Edward de Vere is guilty. And it's half tongue in cheek. It goes more deeply into a lot of the evidence. I wanted to play the very end though. Let's see if I can find, yeah. I'll just play the ending of this.
De Vere wrote, "For truth is truth, though never so old, and time cannot make that false, which once was true." I'm going to enter the testimony of one person in its entirety. David McCullough, famed historian, author of Truman, John Adams, among others. He had the National Book Awards Medal for Distinguished Contributions, a letter, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor. Let me read this. This is the foreword in the book by Charlton Ogburn Jr., and I think sometimes people do not fully take into account what he says. I must have glasses.
It was over, let me put up the text for you. There we go. It was over dinner in a Washington restaurant nearly 20 years ago that I first talked about the mystery of William Shakespeare. We had met to discuss a book on geology of North America, a book he was to write and I was to edit. At that point, I knew him only as the author of several books. I had greatly enjoyed The Gold of the River Sea, The Winter Beach, a writer of intelligence and integrity and wonderful feeling for the natural world. Of his interest in Shakespeare, I knew nothing. But once he got started on the subject, I could hardly let him stop. Though until then, like almost everybody, I'd been perfectly willing to accept The Man from Stratford-on-Avon as the author of the plays and sonnets. And while I knew there were those who raised doubts about that, I imagined that they were mostly cranks. Like most of the people in this room, we started out maybe a little cranky. It was absolutely spellbinding. The case he made against The Man from Stratford-on-Avon seemed to me astonishing against my client, overwhelming. And the more he went on, the more impressed I was both by his penetrating mind and his phenomenal grasp of the subject. He seemed to understand Shakespeare better than anyone I had ever met. I kept thinking, what a shame his audience wasn't larger. Now comes the mysterious William Shakespeare. And this brilliant, powerful book is a major event for everyone who cares about Shakespeare. The scholarship is surpassing. Brave, original, full of surprise. And in the hands of so gifted a writer, it fairly lights up the sky. Looking back on that evening years ago, I felt as if I had been witness to the beginnings of a literary landmark. Nothing comparable has ever been published. Anyone who considers the Shakespeare controversial silly or a lot of old stuff is in for a particular surprise. This is scholarly detective work at its most absorbing. More, it is close analysis by a writer with a rare sense of humanity. The strange, difficult, contradictory man who emerges as the real Shakespeare, Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, is not just plausible, but fascinating and wholly believable. It is hard to imagine anyone who reads the book with an open mind ever seeing Shakespeare of his works the same way again. That Charlton Ogburn persisted and succeeded in so monumental a task, all alone, without institutional backing, without the support or blessing of academia, makes the accomplishment all the more extraordinary. David McCullough. So the picture emerges, Shakespeare's knowledge of law, music, Italy, language, power. I could have talked about gardens because Cecil House had one of the great gardens and one of the most famous gardeners whose knowledge was complete. Shakespeare's books, Golding's Metamorphoses, Castiglione's The Courtier, Cardinal's Comfort, all this intimate to Shakespeare and intimate to De Vere. Shakespeare's acquaintances, Spencer, Lilly, Munday, the Earls of Southampton, Pembroke, and Montgomery. Shakespeare in Hamlet, Shakespeare's word creation, literary accolades, the testimony of historian David McCullough. If writing the plays and poem is a crime, and you are the grand jury, I think it's pretty clear my client is innocent. When you put together all the dots on the canvas, there is only one picture that emerges, and that is Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford. Ladies and gentlemen of the grand jury, the defense rests.
Fun. Fun to do. Okay, enough about Shakespeare. Let me make some final movie recommendations for you. Not Shakespeare. I had this pile yesterday, but I forgot to go through it. First of all, I put this on Facebook, but If you want to see a Chinese epic to end all epics, Red Cliff, the 5-hour version, okay? That's the one you want to get. A lot of battle, a lot of martial arts, but also beauty, beautiful stuff. There's it takes place centuries ago when there were three kingdoms in China and a battle and some attempts to, I don't know, there, but there's some scenes in here of exquisite beauty that will surprise you. The one Woody Allen movie that I have unreserved love for is Midnight in Paris. Midnight in Paris. If you could go back in time and spend time in Paris with who all did he meet? Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Picasso, Salvador Dali, a bunch of artistic things. It's just a perfectly done movie. I already mentioned Inception. That's an incredible movie. Among foreign films, more foreign films, and I'm sure most of you already saw this, Amelie. This, if you really just want a lighthearted romp, watch this again. It is just one of the most innocent, loving, beautiful movies ever made. This is a Mahanta movie, Cold Comfort Farm. And by Mahanta, I mean a Mahanta movie is a movie where a character, just being themselves, transforms everybody around them. If you remember the old James Stewart movie, You Can't Take It With You, you know, that's the same kind of thing, a Mahanta movie. So Cold Comfort Farm, that's Kate Beckinsale before she became, you know, a martial arts star. Dean Spanley, another Mahanta movie. I can't even tell you what this is. It's one of Peter O'Toole's later movies. You'll recognize Sam Neill, among others. This movie, you'll not understand. I'm not going to tell you about it. Have any of you seen this movie?
No.
No?
Yes, nobody? I have. It's the best movie around. I've watched it about 10 times.
Oh, it's like when it starts, you'll be kind of wondering, where is this going? And then at a certain point, you'll start getting it. And it's like, oh my gosh. This was written by a baron in England, surprisingly. It's a brilliant story, a brilliant movie, just perfect for you guys. And I mentioned The Dark Knight as well, of all the Batman movies. This is a perfect film, and it's the one where Batman, by the end. By the way, this is a great one for writers to understand what's really going on. And for writers, if you're writing a story, one of the things is that there's the protagonist, and in this, obviously, Batman is the protagonist. Then there's an antagonist and a relationship character. The relationship character is kind of with the protagonist and they have exchanges and it illuminates things, whereas the antagonist stops the protagonist, is trying to stop the protagonist from getting what he wants. In this movie, Batman wants to retire, okay? And there's a guy named Harvey Dent who is a district attorney and he's going after the bad guys and stuff. So who is the antagonist in Batman, The Dark Knight? It's not the Joker. The Joker is the relationship character. And if you understand that, because the Joker is trying to tell Batman, you're like me. It's all about chaos. The Joker, as portrayed here, unlike anybody else, gets it right because it's the Joker represents chaos. Okay, and he argues that that's what Batman is as well. Batman wants Harvey Dent to save Gotham City. Harvey Dent fails and lets him down. He's in the way. He's not stepping up the way he should. So by the end, Batman realizes to save Gotham, he has to take on the city karma and become the bad guy in their eyes, even though he isn't, in order for Gotham to move on. It's just a perfectly brilliantly written script. It's amazing. And of course, you all know this one, Groundhog's Day. Perfect movie. You just, you know, it's one of, by the way, perfect movies. I call them perfect because it's almost like if you're changing channels or something and you stumble into it, you're right there and you're going to go to the end. You know, you're going to just hang in there with it. Now, this one was originally called Edge of Tomorrow and they changed the title for some reason. And they call it Live, Die, and Repeat. Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. This is one of the most perfect time travel movies ever done.
Very good.
Yeah, I watch it all the time.
It's just, it's a perfect movie. And they, you know how when you do time travel, like Groundhog's Day was perfect because you kind of, well, it's like in a loop, right? You're in a loop. Groundhog's Day was perfect because they looped it just right. They didn't have too much. They didn't cut it too fine. They didn't have excess. Same here. There's no excess in the loops here. And it's battling aliens who are unlike any other aliens before. It's a brilliant movie. And then, of course, there's always the classic, The Princess Bride.
Oh, I love that movie.
Go back and I mean, if you haven't seen The Princess Bride, you just got it. This is written by William Goldman. This is the guy who wrote this was the same guy who wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, for example. Brilliant writer, and the movie is brilliantly realized. So.
Did you ever see My Favorite Year with Peter O'Toole?
Yes.
That was another one where a really damaged character finds his truth at last, and it's a great movie.
Yeah.
I laughed my head off watching it too.
Anybody else have any movie recommendations?
I love Black Stallion because of the music. I think it's fabulous. The cinematography and the relationship between a boy and his horse. You know, so it's real.
You probably like The Man from Snowy River as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Did you ever see, it's a documentary called
Fantastic.
The documentary Buck, the original horse whisperer.
Yeah.
It's a documentary.
Yeah, I saw that.
He's amazing. It's an amazing documentary.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Speaks the language. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like Cold Mountain.
Cold Mountain. Ooh.
I know. Well, Renee Zellweger was so good. What can you say?
Well, yeah. I mean, she's kind of amazing. We really love Cabaret. And we still go back and watch all the Richard Curtis films. You know Richard Curtis? He did Four Weddings and a Funeral, Bridget Jones's Diary, Notting Hill, all brilliant. And then Love Actually is the one that, you know, the Christmas classic.
Yeah.
You haven't seen Love Actually?
Oh, that's good.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Great movie.
Lorraine, you haven't seen it?
Yes, I have.
Oh, okay. I thought everyone saw that
Ken
one.
Ken watches every chick flick on the planet.
Okay.
He loves chick flicks, so I watch them.
I thought Notting Hill was a masterpiece, too. I just love the way that unfolded.
Yeah, you know, and it's Richard Curtis who wrote The Vicar of Dibley. He also wrote Blackadder. Do you know Blackadder? Yeah. So it's that same kind of, that's where he plied his trade in TV. Kind of things, but yeah, we constantly do the British things. There's a British short, like a short 13 episode British series called Mulberry. Does that ring a bell with anybody?
Mulberry is it M-U-L?
Yeah, M-U-L-B-E-R-R-Y. It's about a young man who shows up to become like a personal assistant to an older woman in a household. He's not as he appears to be. It's a very uplifting, unusual movie. We're rewatching that, The Vicar of Dibley. We're watching Vera, the final season of Vera that was out. We always kind of have like British.
I love those
series going on.
And the guy that wrote Downton Abbey, he's written a new one, Belgravia Fellows, he's called.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
It's good.
Good.
I liked I Am Sam.
The movie, that's the Sean Penn movie, right?
Yeah. That's very powerful.
Okay. Well, I don't have much more than that. I'm glad you guys came along for the ride. It's been fun. So.
Oh, you have so much more than that.
Okay. Well, I do, but I have to get to work. I actually have to start spending more time making money than... You know, because, you know,
thank you.
It's kind of tough.
I know.
But hey, if you bought any of my books, go give me 5-star reviews on Amazon.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, I already see some of you already have. Micheline, what are you going to say?
I was going to ask you, you know, I went on Amazon and I look for your book, and one of them, I can find it now. It was about, it's for $989.
There are people who do that kind of garbage all the time.
I know. But I was going to ask you, so if you wrote it in a past life, how are you going to get the profit now because you're under-
Well, you know,
from the experience.
Somebody's making money off of these books, and it's not me.
But, you know, really?
Yeah. At the time, I
when it's I for the children.
I had two daughters still alive in their 70s, and I almost played with the idea of maybe I'll show up and just say, "Hi, it's Dad, I'm back," you know, but yeah, it probably wouldn't have happened.
Oh, man. Well, hey, I would love to have a reunion call at some point where we talk about what we got out of all of this and how it's moved our life in a different direction. I just think that would be a great conversation to have.
Oh, good idea. Yeah. Okay.
I'll keep it in mind.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
Did you ever listen to the score to Somewhere in Time?
Well, we own that movie too. Somewhere in Time is.
Did you know that was his best selling? Even all those Bond movies, and he did Born Free.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, he did.
It was his best selling.
Out of Africa. We're talking about John Barry.
Yeah, he did Dancing with Wolves, but. But he did this one just basically on spec. He wasn't getting paid. He was friends with Jane Seymour. Yeah. And he wrote and said, okay, but you got to give me the royalties to all And he made more money from Somewhere in Time than any of his incredible hits.
By the way, there's one soundtrack you probably don't know of his. And I only knew about it that because when we went to the Ekinkar seminar in Montreal, we went to an IMAX movie. And it was called Across the Sea of Time, and it was an aerial view and history of New York City, of Manhattan.
Ew. And
when the music came on, I was like, wait a minute, that's John Barry, because, you know, Dances with Wolves, you just know his music. And so it's called Across the Sea of Time. Find that soundtrack. It's a stellar soundtrack of his.
Yeah.
The movies that win the Oscars for foreign language are always wonderful, really fantastic movies.
Yep. I agree.
Thank you so much, Mark. This was really fun.
Oh, thank you so much. That's
really fun.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, if we do a reunion show, I'll let you all know.
Oh, good. Yeah. Nice to be here
with
everybody.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Bye. Bye. I know you're watching this on the recording. Okay.
Thank you again, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Appreciation. Bye.